One of our most provocative and entertaining cultural critics considers whether much of what we think we know about reality is false, why that is, and why it matters. Chuck Klosterman does so in his new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. Klosterman says it's impossible to understand the world of today until today has become tomorrow. Chuck Klosterman is the author of 7 nonfiction books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and I Wear the Black Hat, as well as 2 novels, Downtown Owl and The Visible Man. He also served as the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine for 3 years. Again, the name of the book is But What If We're Wrong? It is published by Blue Rider Press. Chuck Klosterman, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Have I been on this show before?
You have been on twice before.
Twice?
Yes.
Wow.
You make the point at the beginning of this book that this is not a collection of essays. Why was it so important for you to make that clarification at the beginning?
Well, okay. That's a good question because it seems like an odd thing to do, right?
To
sort of tell people how they're supposed to read the book. I guess it's because I'm just known as an essayist, and the way this book is structured topically, it could really give the impression that you can read these in sort of whatever order you want. And you can, of course. People can read the book however they want. But some of the ideas in the book kind of build on each other. So I was like, why don't I just tell people it makes more sense to read this book straight through? There's no downside to that. I mean, they could still ignore me. But my hope was that this would be more perceived as a book with many different versions of the same idea as opposed to kind of freestanding monoliths or whatever, you know.
So that idea of that it's impossible to understand the world of today until today has become tomorrow, how did you latch on to that concept and then want to investigate it further?
I think that maybe unconsciously I had been writing this book for half my life. Like, I wasn't really thinking about it as a book, but that question has always sort of been part of the way I view the world, that maybe my sense of reality is unstable because it seems as though the history of ideas is the history of people being wrong. And it doesn't seem that the people experiencing the world seem to get to decide how that memory exists, that we have a day-to-day way we view the culture and the way we view art and politics and sports and science and religion and all of these things. But it's people who come after us, people who have not even been born, who sort of dictate what this reality supposedly was. So I was like, okay, I accept that, but I'm just going to try to get myself in the mind of that future person and try to look at the world of today the way a historian will later.
What does that allow you to explore through the practice of that experiment?
Well, I think it's just, the short answer is just that it's kind of interesting. Is there a high utility in this? Is there, like, some benefit? Well, maybe the fact that it's a little bit humbling to realize that what we think is happening in our world now is a temporary idea. I think that there's a sense of sort of excitement in the idea that the way we think the reality is, that maybe it's just, you know, somewhere in between what's actually happening and what someone will decide what else happened. I think it's just a kind of a fascinating thing. I mean, this is ultimately a thought experiment. I'm not trying to persuade people to necessarily think differently about what they believe, but I'm just trying to open up the possibility for everyone to say, well, what I believe might be wrong, in fact, is probably wrong because that's how it's always been.
You talk rather early in the book, you have a chapter entitled A Brief Examination as to Why This Book is Hopeless and a Briefer Examination as to Why It Might Not Be. And you start off by talking about lists. You are very much a person who is interested in lists. And what is it about that allows us to kind of think of why the book would be hopeless and well, maybe in the future, why it won't be?
Well, what I talk about is, you know, as a kid, I used to like this thing called the Book of Lists, which people from the 70s and early 80s may remember. It was
I love that book.
A big, thick, it was like the internet on paper, kind of. It was just lists of things, many of which were subjective. But the makers of that book also made a different book called the Book of Predictions that came around around the same time, and it was talking to people about what they thought the world would be like in 50 years. Now, if you read the Book of Predictions now, or if it's ever referenced in the media, it's usually to point out the kind of absurd things people got wrong. Of course, a few things are correct, but what intrigued me was sort of the reasons that people were wrong. And the main reason people were wrong about almost every prediction they made about America, this is from 1979, was that they could not envision a world where America was not at odds with the Soviet Union, and that the possibility of nuclear holocaust was always right around the corner, and there was fear that maybe the Soviet Union would get into an alliance with China. Interestingly, not one person seemed to ever visualize the possibility that the Soviet Union would just sort of fold under its own weight. That really wasn't on the table. But the thing is, this is what is the problem with predictions and why I don't make predictions very much in this book. I mean, sometimes I do playfully, but for the most part, it's like, to make a prediction, you're working from the premise that the way the world is looked at now is how the world will be looked at forever, and that's really the thing that changes. In 50 years or 100 years or 500 years, it won't just be that our tastes and our opinions have changed. It'll be the way that people look at the world, the way they categorize things as insignificant or interesting or uninteresting. Those are the things that sort of evolve, and that's what I'm trying to sort of get around the curve on and get ahead of.
You say, in talking about the Book of Predictions, that what's most instructive about that book is not the things that they got right. It was the bad calculations that must have seemed totally justifiable at the time of publication. And I assume you stumbled across that in this, that right now this seems like total common sense.
Well, I mean, almost everything, or not even common sense. Sometimes this is the manifestation of the best data we have. I've been interviewed a few other places, and they always want you to make predictions, and I'm always trying not to. But one thing I've sort of referenced is it seems real plausible that there could be a point in the future where we find a new way to combat cancer, some sort of biogenetic way to deal with cancer. And as a result, they look back at chemotherapy, and they're like, whoa, we used to pump poison into people to help them live. You know, it will seem real barbaric and crazy. And it's not. I mean, chemotherapy is not a crazy thing to do. Now, it's our best move in that scenario. But in the future, it will seem crazy because the information will have changed. In much the same way, you know, we look back at people in the past, and, you know, there was a time when they thought, you know, illness was caused by, like, trolls and gnomes. And when they had that information, they were like, well, finally we know that trolls cause illness. You know, it's not the gods, it's trolls or whatever. We just look back on that and laugh, but that's how it always works, you know?
So that idea of thinking about the present as if it were the past, does that not give us some sense of disposal to how we are looking at things currently?
Well, I guess one way you could make that argument. You could say that there's a hopelessness here.
Right.
That if we're conceding that the way we look at the world now is going to be wrong, why try at all? Well, I mean, I guess my response to that is that there is no other option. Okay, you can't just decide that because something is probably unknowable, I'm just going to give up on the quest. You got to do the best you can, right? I mean, at some point, logic would say we will be right about these things. I talked to one scientist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who basically said we're in that time, and that, like, there's not going to be another Copernican revolution. We're not going to rethink or shift the paradigm of scientific thought. Like, what we know now is what's happening. That could very well be. But, of course, we're not the first generation to have thought that way.
And when you bring science into it, and I guess the best place to start in a conversation like this is climate change. You have many, 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 many scientists who say that our planet is headed for destruction. You have a few who say that it is not. And you look at it, and then, of course, there's the political ideology that gets entered into the equation. And then at the end, it seems that in this case, it's something that we can actually do something about, but what and what is in the future, will we look back and say, oh, that was the right thing?
Well, you know, there's probably two pages in this book on climate change, because in a lot of ways, climate change doesn't fit into what I'm doing here. I mean, what I'm trying to do is deal with questions that seem so obvious they aren't being asked at all. And certainly climate change is being debated. Granted, 98 or whatever percent of the scientific community says it is happening, you know, and it doesn't really seem up for debate. I mean, we can measure the amount of carbon in the air. These are not speculative things, you know. It's not like, I mean, when people discuss climate change, they still talk about it like it's some kind of theoretical thing. It's a measurable thing. But the things that people don't talk about climate change are like, well, what if the climate changes and we just adapt to it? Like, is that, it doesn't seem like that's even on the table. It seems like there are only two arguments, one that the world is being destroyed, the other being this isn't happening at all. You know, what about the area in between? I'm not saying that's what's going to happen or the most likely thing that's going to happen or that's the real answer. I'm just saying that it's something that we don't discuss because it doesn't seem like there's room for it in the conversation.
You have a chapter in the book called Don't Tell Me What Happens, I'm Recording It. You're writing about television in much of this, and you say that both collectively and individually, the experience of watching TV in 2016 already feels totally disconnected from the experience of watching TV in 1996. And you say, I doubt the current structure of television will exist in 250 years or even in 25.
It does seem as though television is the most dynamic medium in terms of art, and that the technology seems to drive it in a way that surpasses every other quality of it. I mean, like, you know, film technology changes, and yet the experience of seeing a film in a theater on a first date isn't that different now than it was in the 70s or the 60s. But television is not like that. I mean, anyone listening to this probably remembers, or if they're old enough, can remember television in the 80s and early 90s. The idea of things like appointment television did not exist. Like, if you missed a show, you just missed it. Maybe you saw the rerun in the summer. The idea that television was something to take seriously, the way you'd take a novel seriously, that didn't happen. Well, that's how it is now. But also, the technical experience of watching television is changing. One television in the house and everyone sitting around it is rare now. Most houses have multiple televisions, or people watch it on their phone or on a computer. They DVR things. They watch things later. They don't watch the commercials. All these things have changed. I can't imagine that the way we watch television now will be at all similar to whatever replaces it in, you know, 100 years.
And as you say, even 25 years. So let's get to the far more important question, which is that of public radio.
Well, now, you know, public radio, in a way, has moved in a smart direction. And it has sort of tried to say, we're going to exist in this very specific space where we can have public conversations at a length that don't happen anywhere else. Now, the only real sort of threat to this is podcasting. Okay, so here's what the question becomes. Who wins between, you know, public radio and podcasting? What will matter to people more? The idea that you can be exposed to something unexpected, which happens on public radio, or the idea that you can select exactly what you want to hear about, which is podcasting. You can find exactly the conversation you want to have. I don't know. The people listening to this might say, well, that's obvious, but they could pick either answer. But that's what I see as the immediate future of public radio.
Meanwhile, when you were ethicist of the New York Times, you wrote about public radio and I believe advised people that they should not feel guilty not giving to their public radio station.
That did come up, yeah. That did come up because, you know, it's kind of a gamble you take as the public radio provider. I mean, what you're saying to people is that we're putting this product out and it is our hope you will financially support this if you want it. But that is kind of the risk you're taking by not being a commercial entity. A person listening to this, if they think this is important to them and it has a value to them, they should contribute. But if they don't, they shouldn't stop listening simply based on that. I mean, people who watch or listen to commercial radio, for example, they can tune out the commercials in their mind. They can turn the station and turn it back. It doesn't mean they can't listen to the music.
When it comes down to the ultimate point, and what, if we read it in order, And we read it from the beginning to end. What would you like people to get out of the book?
Well, you know, that's a thing a lot of people have been asking me. They often ask, like, you know, is this an optimistic book? Are you saying it's kind of wonderful or exciting to think that reality is transient and temporary? Is it a pessimistic book? Are you saying that it's hopeless to imagine? I kind of think of it more as a neutral charge, that the future is going to be different, but not better than or worse. It'll seem worse if you're really used to the way things used to be, but actually it'll just be a different kind of experience. My hope when someone reads this book is that when they finish, they go like, that was interesting. I enjoyed the 288 pages I invested in this. I am not the kind of guy who's like, I want to persuade you to think the way I do. I mean, I guess sometimes I inadvertently write in a kind of persuasive style, but that's not the goal. I mean, my goal is to allow people to have an interesting time inside their own mind, that they can just think about things that they don't normally think about, because I had the luxury of my life to sort of put a lot of time into having weird thoughts.
But is neutral sexy? I mean, do we want to think of all of this and what we're living through as just sort of neutral?
Well, hey, this is public radio. We got to be sexy, you know? I mean, that's always the thing. I just did another interview with somebody, and his question was sort of like, well, you know, how many people want to do this? How many people are interested in how people who have not yet been born will think about this time? And I was like, you know, I'm not Beyonce. I don't need to sell 2 million copies of this book. If I sell 60,000, it's awesome. So I'm looking for 60,000 people who want to have these kind of weird thoughts. That's how I look at it.
Okay. Know? All right. Well, it's very honest of you. The name of the book is But What If We're Wrong? It is published by Blue Rider Press. Chuck Klosterman, it's very nice to have you back on the program.
Hey, and it was great to be back.
I look forward to having you back again and having you remember it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Again, the name of the book is But What If We're Wrong? The book is published by Blue Rider Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.